Hey guys, it's Tosh. Before we get started today, I just wanted to do a quick disclaimer. The episode that we are about to listen to ended up being quite long, so we decided to go ahead and split it into two parts. So today's episode will be a part one, and then we will continue with next week's episode as part two. Hope you guys enjoy. Hey guys, welcome back to the Moms Talk Autism podcast. Today we have a very special guest with us. So sit tight and we will be right back.
When you become a mom, you never imagine your child getting an autism diagnosis. It feels like your dreams have shattered, like a framed photograph falling off your mantle, exploding into a thousand pieces. But instead of trying to glue those pieces back together, this community of moms is here to help you build a new dream, a better one. So join in the conversation as us moms talk autism.
Hello, everybody. Okay, today we have with us somebody very special. I don't even know if I can give her the proper introduction because she is an incredible woman, incredible mother. She is an advocate for the autism community, for her son, and for so many others. So with us today, we have the lovely Monica Meyer.
That's me.
That's her. I am your host, Tosh, and Shannon is the co-host.
Shannon's just along for the ride.
Shannon's always along for the ride.
You know?
Okay, so let me do a little explaining of who lovely Monica is. For any of us, or for any of you out there, our listeners who heard any of the episodes with our husbands telling their story, their side of the story, my husband Tyler shared with you guys about his high school sweetheart, the first girl. He said, "I love you too." So sweet. Anyways, he shared about her brother Michael. He shared a funny story about Michael loving, firefighters, but also loving nuns. So if you have not heard that episode, then y'all need to go and listen. But that truly was Tyler's, I would say, first introduction to somebody with, you know, an invisible disability, with somebody, maybe just a disability altogether. And it kind of shaped him as a young gentleman, for his future and for, the future of his child who is autistic that he would, you know, eventually find out about. So Monica is a lovely woman who has been doing all the advocacy since way back when, because Michael is in his late 30s.
Yep. Yes. He's 39.
Yes, 39. So she has been in it before there was anything.
Even before IDEA, the Individuals with Disability Act.
Yeah.
It didn't come out until 91 and Michael was born in 83.
Yes. Yeah. Yeah. So she is, y'all, she is a trailblazer. She is a trailblazer. Mm-hmm. She is a pioneer. She really has paved a lot of the ways in the state of Washington. So we're excited. We are excited to have her on today and for her to tell her story with Michael, because you know, we always want to be gentle with sharing too much about our children and being able to keep, you know, their autonomy. And so this is her story through the journey of raising an autistic son. Yeah.
Well, I think that's it, right?
That's okay. We're done.
We're done.
That's all.
Thanks for coming.
So Monica, share with us that the beginning, because, you know, like we just said, there's so much access now.
Yes.
And still not enough, you know, but, but we, Shannon and I, and all of the listeners out there, a lot of us should feel privileged in consideration of where things were back then.
Right.
So tell us, let's start with Michael's diagnosis. Yeah. And just. Yeah.
Well, and it was interesting because sometimes I'll go back and I'll just read his baby book, and it was more of a diary for me because Molly and Michael are 22 months apart. And so I was concerned at a very early, when he was about 6 months old.
Yeah.
And I thought, something's wrong.
You had a feeling.
Something's not wrong. Something's different. Not wrong. Something was different. Because he always clenched his hands together, just kind of really tight. And I thought, well, what's that? So there was his doctor, his pediatrician just basically said, you know, he'll grow out of this by the age of three. He's fine. And I'm like, yeah, not so much. I just, you know, he's a boy. They're just slower than girls. And I was like, no, something's different, because he wasn't sitting up even at 9 months.
Okay.
He had very low muscle tone. And he didn't walk until he was 18 months, but it still fell within the typical milestones.
And Michael was not like premature or anything like that?
No. Matter of fact, he was late.
Okay.
He was 10 pounds. 23 inches. Ooh. He was a big boy.
Shannon's eyes. Both of my babies were little, so that is big.
Yeah, like,
natural childbirth, by the way. But you know, it just, and I worried. I was just like, what in the world is going on? And I just, it was just you know, listening to professionals, and then of course there was no internet.
Yeah.
You know, it was looking up in the yellow book, you know, the yellow pages. It's like, I don't even remember what it's called. Phone book. Yeah. And just looking for things.
Like just trying to find a doctor or something that would.
And then we moved. We moved. I can't remember what age. But yeah, because Michael was a year, and we moved to Portland, and his pediatrician referred us to, at the time, it's a horrible name. It was up by Oregon Health Science University, and it was the Crippled Children's Center.
Oh my goodness.
Oh my goodness.
Isn't that horrible? I mean, obviously, and it took a few years before it would change to, the Child Development Center.
Right. Oh my gosh.
Isn't that terrible?
Oh, no better, do better, I guess, right?
Yeah, we've come,
come a long way. Yeah. And because anyway, they did an evaluation, and Michael, the only thing that they said that, you know, he looked like he had a lot of sensory issues.
Okay.
A lot. I mean, he, even when he started walking, he was walking on the sides of his feet. So his soles would not touch. He would walk on the edges of his feet.
Oh, geez.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And so we started going to occupational therapy and all this kind of stuff. And of course, reading back on it, it was like blatant. It was obvious, you know, now knowing, but it wasn't until he was seven. And that was after I was a clinical manager for a pediatric internal medicine clinic. Mm-hmm. And it just happened the day that I had to take Michael in, because he always had a lot of ear infections. Took him in because he had an ear infection, that we had a substitute doctor that only worked one day a week, because she was a mom herself and wanted to stay home with her kids. But she was a developmental behavioral pediatrician. And I mean, on the off chance, how random is that? And so it took Michael in, and Michael is sitting beside me, but he's playing with my hair. He always held on. I had long hair, and he would hold onto my hair just like it was kind of bracing him. And I was just talking, and she's just kind of looking at me, and she goes, "Monica, I didn't know that you had a son with autism." Oh, and I said, "Oh, I didn't either."
I was, and just, this is at 7.
This is at 7 years of age. Yeah. Even at that, there was we really don't even have good diagnosticians yet, even in our state.
Right.
She diagnosed him. And then from that, it just kind of, it did change. Well, changed the direction. It's just like, oh my God. I was like, almost like I've got an answer.
Yeah.
I can get my hands around something.
Some research. Yes. Yeah. Yeah.
And so.
Well, so quickly, what did, cause seven, not having a diagnosis until 7, mm-hmm. Which that is obvious that it does not, oopsie, hang on everybody. Sorry about that. Not having a diagnosis till 7, that doesn't happen hardly ever anymore,
no.
Right?
Yeah.
So what did school look like? Because 7, he is in first grade. Yeah.
But he did go through early intervention services.
Okay. So there was early intervention then.
Yeah. There was birth to 3, but that was very random. I mean, it was just kind of a hit and miss. Mm-hmm. That's when we lived in Eugene and University of Oregon, they had a program and someone would come out to the house once a month.
Oh, buddy.
I know. And then when we moved, then he was, we had a, you know, quasi diagnosis of developmental disability, didn't even say sensory, just developmental disability, mm-hmm. and that he qualified for services. And that's, we lived in Portland at the time. And I went to go see the birth to 3 because he was still in that age bracket because he was about 2 then. And I went to see it and I was like,
no way.
There is no way in hell I'm going to be sending my child there.
Yeah.
We couldn't. And so I found a private one. And it was just so happens that Michael's dad at the time was working with a woman who had just recently had a child with Down syndrome. And she was taking her child, and she lived in Tigard, and was taking her child to Vancouver, to Clark College. And it was called the Pride Program. And I can't remember what the acronym was, but it was basically a birth to 3 program, but it was private, but it was a cooperative, meaning you as a parent had to work there. Yeah. Mm-hmm. And so that was, he went there for 2 years and it was fabulous. I mean,
Shannon, almost kind of like ABA now.
Yeah.
Right. Mm-hmm. Yeah. Okay. Okay.
But it wasn't, though he had speech and language, he had, occupational therapy and he also had, but he, it wasn't like, you know, like ABA in the way of discrete trial or pivotal response. It was,
right.
It was more play. More actually, yeah, it was more pivotal response. Yeah, and it was play based, which was really helpful for me because I learned how to do so much in that.
Yeah.
And that's, I think I told you that's when I started working a graveyard shift. Mm-hmm. So I was working at night so I could take Michael to his program, which was 3 days a week. And so that way I had to pay for it. I mean, even though his dad was working, it was just like it wasn't free then. I mean, it wasn't
covered
charge.
Covered by insurance.
No.
Yeah. Yeah. Yeah.
No, you had to pay for it and I had to get my time. So it was quite a commitment. And then, I mean, that's when things, then he went to the 3-5 program in the Evergreen School District mm-hmm. here in Vancouver. Mm-hmm. And let me see, he went to, before he was in first grade, he had gone to 5 different schools.
Oh my gosh.
Different quote programs.
Because they just couldn't figure out mm-mm. what to do with them.
He did have some challenging behaviors. And because it was sensory overload, it was auditory sensitivity. He was in a classroom with a lot of kids. And this is going to sound horrible. It is horrible. Matter of fact, it makes me sick. But one of the things that they did is they built a platform. It was an 4x8 piece of plywood that they built a chair that was affixed to it and then tied Michael into it because they had tried to tie him in a chair before, but Michael would just get up and run with the chair on his back to get him to sit. Yes.
Shannon's.
This is a true story.
If you guys could see us, Shannon's eyes are saucers. Well, both of our eyes are saucers, but like I'm just, and I just have to say this because it's, we've talked to other people and maybe not necessarily parents of autistic children or kids or adults, but other specialists that have enlightened us of what things used to be like.
Right.
And it still just.
Well, ABA therapy, I had such an aversion against it.
Yeah.
Because of the initial Lobos, UCLA, he was the one who basically,
founded it.
But it was, it was not just, positive and discipline. It was sit in your seat. It was very rough.
Yeah. Very, very, very aggressive. Yeah.
Yeah.
Oh man. And this is happening in a public
school
district.
Mm-hmm. Yes.
Wow. So, because it's crazy for me to think about that because now, there's obviously still bad districts out there. We see it still all the time in the news. Mm-hmm. Where teachers or some kind of, school employees put their hands on children.
Yes.
But back then, was it like, this is just part of protocol or how did you like,
but I didn't even know that it was happening because, there wasn't, although there was an educational plan, it wasn't an IEP because IEPs really, there wasn't a protocol for them until IDEA 91.
Yes. Yeah.
And so, it wasn't. And then I think it was in the early 90s that, they really started reinforcing positive behavior support plans.
Okay. Yeah. Yeah.
And actually with the reauthorization in 97, that was such a big, big deal negative or adversities do not, weren't used in schools well, and they still are, but by law that they couldn't. And it just gave me there was a law behind it. It gave me some teeth to say, you can't do this.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Yeah. Yeah.
And so I was able to have a bigger voice and just say, no, this isn't going to happen.
Yeah. 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 So this is happening when Michael is in now, let's just say he's in, because he's seven when he has a diagnosis, he's skipped around to a few different schools. So he's still in elementary school when this is happening.
Right.
He's segregated into a SPED
room. Yes, a contained classroom. As they call it, life skills now. Yeah, but it was a contained classroom that only had children with disabilities, and they were the whole gamut of
ranges of disabilities. So they had kids in there that had Down syndrome. Mm-hmm. They had kids in there who were
emotional autistic behavior.
Autistic in speaking, autistic in non-speaking.
Well, the funny thing is there weren't that many kids with autism. There weren't that many autistic kids. Right. They're just, matter of fact, in Michael's birth to 3 and 3 to 5, he was the only one that was different. Yeah. The rest had Down syndrome. Or or microcephalia, or something along that line, or maybe cerebral palsy, but not autism.
Autism. Wow.
No, and that's when it just really started. Really until mid 90s that there started to be more kids showing up, and actually towards the end of the 90s. And it was just because I was working for a birth to 3 center and I was on a diagnostic team that we were seeing more kids. Matter of fact, the speech and language, the whole a multidisciplinary team, it was a birth to 3 program. It was like, where are these kids coming from?
Yeah.
There was all of a sudden this big
wave
of kids with autism, autistic kids that were, the whole range of just needing speech and language to, they needed the sensory.
I wish I could remember, Shannon, you've probably seen the documentary. I will find it and I will put it in the show notes.
Oh, that one.
Yes. Okay. For all of you out there. Anyways, it's a very good documentary. I don't remember if it's Netflix, something like that. We will figure it out. But it follows a story of a young man who it was back in and around that time, around 93, where they were recognizing this. And they talk about that same thing, you know, that there just wasn't anybody else out there like their son. And it was really just this trying to, you're essentially educating yourself. You're
absolutely,
because I mean, and we still do that, right? Like just because you've met one autistic person doesn't mean you
know
all, right. Yes. But it's like, then it especially was, you know, this still just so in the dark, people had no idea. You know, and so is Michael non-speaking or speaking?
Michael speaks. Okay. I would typically, he would be identified as being functionally nonverbal.
Okay. Okay.
Because he does talk, but it's more echolalia, repetitive, repetitive use of known phrases,
right,
those type of things.
Yeah. Scripting. Yeah.
Occasionally he will come out with something and it's like, wait a minute.
Yeah.
But he does, if he wants to communicate, he will write it down.
Okay.
Or he'll point at it, or he uses visuals.
Yeah. I'm going to assume they didn't have AAC devices back then. Okay.
No.
Just to clarify.
No. And even when they first came out, they were just huge and clunky, and they were like $4,000 or $5,000.
Oh, gosh.
And insurance did not pay for it.
Yeah. Yeah.
And when, it's
pretty incredible to me, though, that Shannon, I'm sure you'll agree, because some people have this journey where it's like when you look back, how things just lined up, you know, none of this journey is perfect. And there is no like, oh, we found out really young and we got all these therapies and everything's just, you know, peachy keen.
Yeah.
But like the fact that you worked with that group,
I know,
you know, and she knew enough about autism that she was able to see that and diagnose him, you know, especially because you think back to like the early on where you knew your mother intuition, your gut was telling you that there was something that was different, obviously, especially because you'd already had Molly, you'd seen what typical looked like, you know? So that is just, it's like there's through the hard, there's still like some of those blessings, I suppose, you know, and I don't know, I don't know how to, I'm not saying that properly, but
in hindsight, they were,
yes,
because if we hadn't moved to Portland,
right,
and then into Vancouver, I think Michael's life would have been, again, much different. Mm-hmm. The outcomes would have been much different.
Mm-hmm.
At least I feel I know that this is where we were supposed to be.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it's been home for, I don't know, quite a few years. I can't remember. Yes. Good heavens. Probably 35 years. So, having the opportunity, obviously, I was on the ICC for birth to three. Mm-hmm. And that's when the evolution of IDEA and then the reauthorization, that the Part B and Part C of IDEA, and that we fought for birth to three to be paid for by the school districts that weren't before.
And can you just share with people really quickly what IDEA is?
Oh, Individuals with Disability Education Act.
Yes. Okay. So you like I said in the beginning, you were a trailblazer in this area.
Yeah. I mean, because it was it was obviously so necessary. And there was just the inkling of, there's this ABA thing, you know, and then they were showing things of, you know, videos, quote, that's what, you know, the first, you know.
Because did SPED come into, when was that created?
Well, special education.
Right.
Actually hadn't been there all along. I mean, really until the 1980s that there was, quote, special education before kids could even be in public school.
Right.
I mean, they weren't even allowed into the school. And if they were, if they had something, then they were on, you know, an auxiliary part of the school in a basement or, you know, some place where they just contained them.
Yeah.
But they weren't, there was no education. There was no, nothing for them to do, really, other than containing them.
Yes.
And even for Michael, I actually, when he was in first grade, she was an advocate from Educational Service District 112 that she showed me this program that Michael was going to go to. I mean, of course, placement was already identified first.
Right.
You know, which is not the way it is now.
Right.
It's not supposed to be that way.
Right.
And she said, so he could either go here or he can go to another place, but you have to decide now, do you want him to ride the bus or do you want him to read Mark Twain? And I said, I want him to do both.
Yeah.
I mean, that was like...
Like what? Why?
I have
why
to make a choice.
Yeah.
I was very confused. And so just the first few years, it was just, it was difficult. I mean, just because he was aggressive, he ran, just keeping him in a building was just
very challenging. Yeah. Yeah.
And so, you know, all the way through elementary, the first time that Molly and Michael were in the same school, it was for 1 year. She was in fifth grade and he was in sixth grade. And even at that, they went at that point, rather than center base, they went to school, your neighborhood school. Mm-hmm. And then they went back to, anyway, it's just been back and forth. But at any rate, that was the first time that the two of them were actually in the same school. And it was just like, oh my gosh. And one teacher, I mean, Mrs. Warren was her name, just a gem of a woman. Mm-hmm. And Ms. Zadak, Peggy Zadak was the other lady that was Michael's para. That she, I mean, and Michael talked about her. I mean, she was basically his Velcro aide every place that he went. And this cute little story that, because he did, I mean, their inclusion part was he was part of their homeroom, basically.
The gen ed class.
Yeah. Mm-hmm. You just go in, you know, for the Pledge of Allegiance, and then he went back out. But that being said, he was there for lunch and they were standing in line and Ms. Zadak is beside Michael and Mr. Davis was the teacher. And these kids are just kind of they're out of line. They're kind of messing around. And he said, hey, get in line or we're not going to lunch. And they all kind of stood in line and they were all just nice. And somebody came by and started talking with Mr. Davis and the kids are still standing there being very good. And, out of the back, Michael goes, is Mr. Davis stupid? And it was like, buddy, come on.
I love it.
I'm just very
just say
frank.
It like it is.
That's it. And, I mean, to this day,
very frank.
I have seen Mr. Davis and he said, that is one thing that he'll never forget. And he said, you remember just saying, Michael, you're right. I told you if you all stood in line, you could go to lunch.
And then,
now let's go to lunch. So, I mean, and the other is that, I can't remember. Oh, Joe Frazier. He was the principal of, Riverview Elementary.
Yeah.
And he happened to be Catholic and he knew because Michael had, you know, he liked nuns. He loved his rosaries. That if he went anywhere, Michael would go, and he would go by the office. And Mr. Frazier caught him on several occasions. And actually, he had gone to Rome, and he brought back Michael holy water and a rosary from Rome.
Oh,
and it was just like
so sweet.
Oh my God! Yeah, yes. It was very sweet.
Yes.
And he made
you guys are Catholic.
Yes, we are.
Okay, I was just gonna make sure. Like, where did this?
Where'd that land at home?
Yeah. Well, and this will, Molly
did
will probably.
Did he just see Sister Act and really like.
It just, you need to talk about things that just kind of like all of a sudden happen together.
Yes.
Well, Molly will get into that.
Yeah.
She said, she has said, my mom sent me to a convent, but I really didn't. She was in a girls club that happened to be at a convent.
Yes.
that she went to. And Michael, I mean, he it was in Beaverton. So we lived off of 164th. And so it was
a
jaunt.
Yeah.
So we stayed there and Michael and I would just hang around. And it was just at the same time, Sister Act came out on video.
Yeah.
And it was just like this. But the other thing is that the sisters, you know, all wore habits.
Yeah.
They all were, loved Michael.
Yeah.
They were very gentle with Michael. And yeah. To this day, we still go to that convent.
Yeah.
And that's kind of laughing because we started going there when he was seven.
So a little side note to that. What was that like growing up on Sundays, were you guys able to go to?
No.
Okay. And I'm assuming the church that you went to did not have a program.
Matter of fact, it was like, you know, just don't bring them. That being said,
not outright don't bring him, but it was just kind
of
this.
No, it was.
Oh, okay.
No, I mean that, no, ooh, that was.
I am just like getting all the exploding head emojis right now. Just like, what is even happening?
So there was a mom, actually two moms that had started at first it was called special needs mass, and then it was an adaptive mass, and it was only once a month, and families of children with disabilities could attend a service. And we had a priest that came over from University of Portland who said mass because the parish priest said he didn't have time for it. So we had to go find somebody that could say mass, that we could have a service together. And it was a beautiful, matter of fact, there was probably of kids with disabilities, and I would say a big part of them were autistic kids. Mm-hmm. That's where I got to know almost all of the autistic kids at the same age that Michael was, because they went to the same mass. But it grew and it grew, and the parish priest shut it down because he said he felt like we were splintering from the church, and we were not giving we always called it collection, but it's our offering.
Tithing, your offering. Yeah.
Right.
Yeah.
Although we all did because we belonged to the parish.
Right.
And so but he said, he was a piece of work.
I think this is, and this is obviously, we will not go down this road. But I think that this is the struggle with so many people in the community, the autistic community, whether it be an actually autistic person or, you know, the parents to autistic children and their believers, you know, that this is the struggle, is where, you know, so many people don't feel that acceptance,
right.
You know, or they don't have any kind of support system within the church. And just they're of that where they just say, you're not welcome, but we're also not going to set something up for you.
Right.
You know, and that's again, my head's exploding, Shannon. I just don't.
Well, because they're saying you're splintering off, but you're splintering off because you're not welcome.
That's it.
You know? Yeah. And I mean, but they're
okay.
Yeah.
And I was still, you know, obviously my faith was very strong.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, I'd gone through Catholic grade school and high school.
Yeah.
I came from a very big, large Catholic family.
Mm-hmm.
That was in my roots, and I was like, not going to give that up.
Yeah.
And I still haven't.
Yeah.
And it,
just another piece though of that advocacy for you, where you were like, no, this is not okay.
This is, yeah, exactly. It was, I just kept going, you know, going to different churches, actually parishes even, to find, and there was, we did go to one, which was by LaSalle, a Holy Redeemer, which is 172nd. Of course, a lot of people don't know what I'm talking about. At any rate, it's like, it was a church. Anyway, it had originally started as a video store.
Okay.
On
for all of you out there that don't know,
video store.
Yeah, what's a video store?
Yeah, they had closed down. They weren't, but it's right on the corner of. It was on Hunter's Mill Plain. Anyway, that's where they held mass for almost 5 years while they were
doing the transition of getting a church.
Yeah, building a church and stuff. Yes, Michael would go there
And yeah.
And the and actually that was one of his jobs when he was in the transition program, that he would go and he would help set up the choir books mm-hmm. in the church pews. Well, actually there were more chairs with and my friend actually happened to be the peer secretary. Mm-hmm. And so he knew people there.
Yeah. So he was in that comfort.
Yeah. Yeah. So it was a place where he would go. We wouldn't be able to stay for the whole thing. And oftentimes I was like, I'll get you a chocolate milkshake. He'd sit there, I'll get you another chocolate milkshake.
Shannon knows the bribing. She's got a French fry, McDonald's French fry girl.
Gotta do what you gotta do.
You do, right? And so that's, you know, we felt
it felt welcoming there.
Yes,
it felt like a family. It felt inclusive.
And the families that were from that had been part of these special needs math were going to this parish as well because they felt really connected as well.
Yeah. So I love that you said that because I want to segue into this. We have so many opportunities now, obviously, with having mm-hmm. social media and having just internet.
Right.
Where we can meet groups of people, or we can meet it through this, you know, our children's school mm-hmm. district, wherever, you know. And I love that you said that that's kind of where you found some of your community, mm-hmm. you know, because what did that look like back then? What was finding community?
Well, finding community. A good friend of mine she's still a good friend of mine. She, in our Birth to Three program, she started a parent coalition and she, that was through, Clark County, and it was, you know, advocating on a legislative level, for services for our kids. Mm-hmm. And, she has a son with, Angelman syndrome. And, I tell her over and over a million times, I said, you know, her name is Sandy. And I said, Sandy, if it hadn't been for you, I mean, I just can't imagine all the doors that had not opened. And, you know, she would say conversely, no, mm-hmm. if it hadn't been for you. Mm-hmm. So and actually there's three of us. There's a woman now, her name is Darla, and she runs, it's called Peace, and it's Parents Empowered and Communities Enhanced. Mm-hmm. And so that's what she does. And it's helping families navigate the service system. Mm-hmm. And so that was, you know,
just came through my PTSO, which is our parent teacher of disabilities at the school district. Mm-hmm. They're just a flyer for them just came through.
Oh, yeah.
So I just now know about that. So I know exactly what you're talking about. That is so neat to
put the pieces together.
Together, yeah.
Because, I mean, Sandy and Darla, who does Peace, we all were advocates, volunteers. Mm-hmm. And then we started working for different agencies. So I started working for ESD 112, which is Educational Service District 112. And I was actually I was a student advocate. Mm-hmm. mm-hmm. I wasn't the parent advocate and I wasn't the teacher advocate. I was for the student. And the school districts, believe it or not, paid for me to do that.
Wow.
Because there were so many, because when ideas started rolling out, people were having, were suing the school districts.
I could imagine. So you had a super career shift.
Yes. I tell you, I had several, yes, seriously, going from, the interesting thing, which, you know, you may or may not, when I was doing clinical management, and actually I moved from, a office in Cascade Park. And then I went into Camas mm-hmm. and I literally got fired from the job. Mm. And it was because, I didn't have anybody to take care of Michael. I was divorced. I had newly divorced. Mm-hmm. Michael was 7. Molly was 9. Excuse me. And, I wasn't able to get to the office until 8:45 because Michael's bus picked him up at 8:15, I get in the car and drive. Straight. And literally I had nobody else mm-hmm. to do it. Mm-hmm. And then because he did not sleep well, I was often up until 1 or 2 in the morning. And, so on my lunch hour, I would go and sleep in my car and I would set an alarm. So I would wake up and I had, I did a good job. I mean, there was no
question
about my ability. And I typically, because at that point, then their dad was, had a night, actually two nights, either Tuesday and then Friday every other week. But I would stay and work, and I was a hard worker. Still am a hard worker, but, they just didn't like that. And there was no support for having, there was no family leave. There was nothing. There was nothing like that. And there was no, you know, any sort of empathy for having a child with a disability at all.
So total discrimination.
Total discrimination. Absolutely. And so that's where my, my life really shifted, which is kind of funny because it's also when I got remarried. Mm-hmm. Cause I had been single for almost 6 years and then, oh Lord. So yeah. So that's when I got into birth through three. And then I went into, ESD 112, and the woman that showed me the school that said either ride the bus or, Mark Train, I took her job.
Oh, how do you like them apples?
I know, right?
I mean, not right. to be, you know, forgive me, Jesus, but like, come on.
But it was kind of interesting. Yeah.
Like, listen, Linda.
And so when I started working there, I happened to work with a school psychologist, and I was being called to, and that's why I got to know almost, I would say, a lot of folks with autism in our community, because the majority of calls that I was going to schools were, and I kept data, I'm a data freak, mm-hmm. were either kids with ADHD mm-hmm. or autism. Mm-hmm. That's mm-hmm. it. I mean, there was an occasional, actually gifted program. I had a couple of those that, and it was like, that's out of my wheelhouse. I don't know what to do for you other than because the families wanted more. And that's when we started talking about developing a cadre to teach teachers how to support kids with autism. And so that's what I did, is I started the Regional Autism Consulting Cadre. And we had 15 different school districts here in Southwest Washington. And for 12 years, I was able to teach teachers
how to
support kids with autism. And we brought in national speakers. We had mentoring from, of all places, Kansas University, which I'm still connected with. I mean, that was my whole education is, I mean, it was, and actually I still am so good friends with most everybody, because it was, teachers felt supported, mm-hmm. and then of all things, to have a parent be the one that's driving this, that then their whole attitude is, you know, parents are, you know, parents aren't our enemies. They're our allies.
Yeah. We should be at this table together supporting this child. Yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
So,
but to say, it's so mind boggling to me that still teachers, are not taught in their education through university.
Right. No, they're not.
A portion of how to teach kiddos with more exceptional needs.
Right.
So there's still teachers that are coming into school districts mm-hmm. that have never, they don't have, I mean, whether they've worked with a child or not, but they've never had any formal training on.
No, it's almost like.
I'm like, is that just bizarre to me or is it bizarre?
It is bizarre because it's, teachers, I mean, are taught how to, manage a classroom,
manage a class. Mm-hmm.
Teach write that. A, you know, write their curriculum,
right.
teach the curriculum, grade and keep data, but how to instruct and support a child to actually, I mean, that was the whole thing. A child, if they're not supported in the environment, they're never going to learn.
Yes.
You can't nail them to an environment and say, you need to learn.
Yes.
And so that was one of the things that the cadre did, is that we developed three different teams. There was early childhood, middle school, and transition.
Yeah.
And that if the school district needed, we would come in and do an assessment or evaluation.
Yeah.
And of that, and from that came several different which was teachers on special assignments, which are TOSAs, mm-hmm. that they would then become their autism specialists in their schools. Mm. And that was until ABA started being paid for by Medicare or Medicaid mm-hmm. or even individual plans. Insurance company.
Yeah. Yeah.
And that didn't even start until 2005. And I mean, our zoo is another mom, and she's in the, it was in 2005, I was governor appointed to an autism task force for the state of Washington. And there were 14 of us, believe it or not, that were making decisions on the state. That was her thing. She had come from Texas, and they had ABA services, and she didn't, she was like,
why,
we need to have it. We need
everywhere. To have it. Yeah.
And so she was really instrumental in getting insurance to pay for ABA services. And that came out of the task force, along with one of the, at the Children's Center, the autism program that also came from that. And then A-STAR, which Dr. Gary Stobey, that came from that. So it was
a lot of the good old state of Washington.
Yeah.
I love it.
Yeah. That came from that work. It was.
Yeah.
Yeah. And I still, like I said, I mean, of these groups of people have been still very support. And I know them. I know the doctors. I know the, neuropsychologists and just because, we're all there. And the interesting thing is most of us were parents in a professional capacity in either education or, psychology, medical, whatever it was, So, and you're right. I mean, it was, when I look at the things that, that I was just kind of put into, and I didn't say no, that was the thing where it's like, oh, I can't do this. And I was just, the work, interesting thing is because when I was a lot younger, I mean, it was even in high school, I was a very shy person, very introverted. Mm. And even, that I could get up in front of a bunch of legislators and talk, and then talk at keynotes and talk at, talked at the National Autism Society of America. Mm-hmm. And my parents were just, you could have pushed
blown
them
away.
Over. Yeah.
But that's like something to say. Shannon's going to just be like, come on with this. Preach it, girl. That is something to say about a parent to an autistic child who will find the way. Will find a way, who will do what it takes.
Whatever it takes.
And yes, it's for their kiddo, but in reality, it's for the bigger, the bigger community, whether it's just within their school district or it's through legislation in their state, I mean, that is just so incredible.
Yeah.
Yeah. And you're ferocious. Like, I would never have thought you were
timid. Think she was
ferocious
timid.
In a gentle, loving way, but she's just very
Michael, literally, he taught me a lot. I mean, seriously, how to speak up and just say, no,
this isn't going to happen.
This isn't going to work.
Yeah.
I mean, I think obviously it was still inside. It was still part of me. I was a very competitive person. I liked competitive sports, those types of things. So, it just, finally
that translated over into this.
Unleashed the lion.
Well, I think we can all say that we are completely different humans now, 100% than we were
for
before.
For the better. I mean, absolutely, and so I will be grateful for that.
Oh,
always.
Yes.
All right, guys, we are going to go ahead and end there for today. But remember, there is still going to be a part two to this episode, which will be dropping next Monday. So stay tuned for that. And as always, don't forget to follow us on Instagram at Moms Talk Autism. Send us a lovely review, or shoot us an email if you have anything you want to say hello at momstalkautism.com. And always, always, always 5-star review, because we appreciate it first and foremost, and it does help us to reach more families like y'all. All right. See you next time.